Welcome to Journey into Excellence, Episode 9. My name is Vernon Boer, and I'll be your host for the next 90 minutes. Journey into Excellence is an ongoing monthly series where experts in their fields will focus on how the evidence-based promotion of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit requires clear thinking and civility in our family, education, and leadership management systems. Each of our expert panelists brings something unique to the discussion, which they will share. And our panelists include Jack Malcolm, the president of Falcon Performance Group, an organization dedicated to improving the professionalism, preparation, and productivity of sales professionals in the complex sales environments. Martin Haysacker, Ph.D., a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Florida. Brian P. Higley, Ph.D. Dr. Higley is president and CEO of the Building Blocks to Excellence, LLC, a company that focuses on promoting team excellence, personal effectiveness, and work-life satisfaction in individuals, teams, and organizations. And last but not least, our special panelists on today's show, in the first of his biannual panel appearances, John Spence. John Spence is one of the top business thought leaders and leadership development experts in the world, who has done extensive work on business and personal excellence, has written several books on the topic, blogs regularly on these topics, has been a TEDx speaker, and regularly produces seminars on business leadership skills. And with that, I turn it over to Dr. Higley to give us an overview of what 2020 and today's show hold in store for us. Take it away, Brian.
All right. Thanks, Vern. Real excited to be here. Journey into Excellence 2020. Last year, Journey into Excellence 2019, we did a lot of exploration into what it means to journey into excellence and what excellence actually is. And I think this year, one of the things that we'll focus on to start with everybody is moving from defining excellence, which is what I think we talked about last year, and do some work this year on the question that I've been exploring with everybody on this panel individually, and now I'm excited to do it together as a group, about why it seems like, at least to so many, that so few people do actually journey into excellence. So I thought I'd just do a real quick review of how we defined excellence last year and then talk a little bit about how we're going to discuss actually doing excellence this year. So last year we talked a lot about how our work overlaps. John's got an awesomely simple model, and people who want to read about that can get his book, Awesomely Simple. Jack writes a lot about being civil and having and being a clear thinker. And then Marty and I write quite a bit about H2O, which is an acronym that stands for Help to Ourselves and Others. And Mal, who's not with us today, but normally Mal Hyman, the sociologist who talks about the political system with us, I think the way I think about him is the old phrase, liberty and justice for all, is one way I would define Mal's work. And I think we all overlap in these areas of excellence as being helpful to ourselves and also being helpful to other people. So we talked last year a lot about, well, what does that mean to be really helpful to ourselves and be really helpful to each other within the three systems that Vern talked about, the family system, the education system, and the leadership system, which includes, to me, business and politics. One of the questions that keeps coming up and I love to explore with folks, and I'm excited to explore with people this year, is if there are so many excellence models out there about how to be helpful to ourselves and others, why does it seem like across the centuries humanity seems to struggle to actually do excellence? And so I pitched the idea over email to all you folks that one way we can talk about journey into excellence is as a heroic journey, that it really does take heroism in many ways to journey into excellence and to encourage other people to do that as well. And whenever I think about heroic journeys, I think about Joseph Campbell's model, the hero's journey. And so I kind of pitched that to everybody and said, what if we talked about moving from just knowing about excellence to actually doing excellence using Joseph Campbell's model as one way in which to look at this, and everybody seemed like they were on board. So what I thought I'd do is just give a quick overview of the hero's journey model as I've come to understand it, and then pitch it on over to Marty to talk a little bit about some of these components in the family system, and then we'll move on to education and leadership systems after that. So the way I've come to understand Joseph Campbell's model is that basically three phases with a bunch of different subcomponents in it, and I think a lot of those subcomponents map on nicely to a lot of the science of learning, change, and growth. So what I'd like to do, and I've asked Marty to be ready to do as well, is to discuss not only the hero's journey model from Joseph Campbell's perspective, but also to bring in some of the science of learning, change, and growth, and even some personality. Marty's our resident personality expert as well, to discuss how this model overlaps with a lot of the scientific evidence. So the first phase of this model is separation. In order to journey into excellence, oftentimes we have to separate out from the norm. And for people who are Star Wars fans, they might be interested to know, or they might already know, that George Lucas used this model to as a foundation for his first three Star Wars movies. So the separation phase is represented in the first Star Wars that actually came out. It's Episode 4, A New Hope. But in that movie, Luke Skywalker, the hero, had to separate out from his old life in order to move into a new life. The second phase is initiation, and this is where people start to learn how to be excellent from other people who are excellent. And this is represented in the original Star Wars trilogy by Return of the Jedi, where much of that movie was Luke Skywalker learning from other masters. I think Yoda was the symbol of mastery in that movie. And then the third phase is return, which is once you've learned to be excellent, you return in some sort of way and share your excellence with the rest of the world. And in the Star Wars trilogy, Return of the Jedi was influenced by the return phase, where Luke Skywalker, the hero, comes back as a Jedi Knight, which is the symbol of expertise and helps to liberate himself and others from the evil empire. So those are the three phases I'd like to talk about. I figured we'd start with separation and get into some of these components and talk a little bit about maybe our own separation or other people's separations or failures to separate. So the first two components of separation are call to adventure, and basically call to adventure just basically means that in some way, shape, or form, a person gets called to pursue excellence. And there's all kinds of ways that all of us get called to sort of separate out from the norm and pursue excellence in some way, shape, or form. So I'd like to talk today about what called us to the adventure, the journey into excellence, and maybe some other things that you all have seen in terms of people being called to become excellent in their own way. And then the second component is refusal of the call. And this has to do with after feeling like something's not right or that you can be better than you are, oftentimes people refuse to journey into excellence for a variety of different reasons. And I'd like to explore those with you as well today. I thought we'd start with those two components and move into other components if we have more time, but maybe that's enough for now. So but I toss it on over to Marty and have him do whatever he wants to do with the call to adventure, the call to a journey into excellence within the family system, what he's seen, what he's experienced, and then refusal of the call, what he's seen, what he's experienced in terms of people who might be called to be better within the family system, but for some reason or another decide that they're not going to pursue excellence in that realm. Marty, does that set you up well enough?
We'll see. So my thoughts have gone a number of different ways. One of the things when you were talking about learning, change, and growth and the psychology of personality, one of the things that came to my mind was Eric Erickson's stages of psychosocial development. And he's got 8 stages, and I would argue that stages 1, 2, and 3, trust versus mistrust, which is for very young children, then a little older children, autonomy versus shame and doubt, and then the third stage with preschoolers. So young children for trust versus mistrust, toddlers for autonomy versus shame and doubt, and for preschoolers, initiative versus guilt. Those three developmental stages, according to Erickson, I think are all tied to this separation section. So you asked me to sort of anchor this in personality psych and learning and growth, and I think that's a nice model to start with. And those are the first three of the seven Ericksonian stages. And what Erickson argues is that if the child is parented effectively and appropriately and in a context that's sufficiently safe and predictable, then the child will sort of naturally resolve each of these challenges in a positive direction. So in trust versus mistrust, if effectively parented and in a safe context, children are likely to trust rather than mistrust their family and the people around them. On the other hand, if there are real challenges in how the children are parented and or real conflicts in the context in which they're raised, it may resolve in them being mistrusting of the world. And autonomy versus shame and doubt, it's a parallel thing. So the ego skill that we want children to develop as toddlers is a sense of autonomy. But if parenting is not done effectively and appropriately, and or if the family is in a circumstance that's fraught, then the child is more likely to resolve in a different direction, which is to be filled with shame and doubt and not be autonomous. So that's sort of an initial movement into that way of thinking. But also let's talk about sort of families themselves and the issue of call to adventure and refusal of the call, the first two steps in that separation phase. So I think they can happen at two levels. The first level is when parents have children, I think it naturally represents a call to adventure, particularly when they have that first child. I think it gives parents an opportunity to think about how they were raised, to think about the parts of that that they benefited from and the parts of that that they maybe struggled with or didn't benefit from. And so that gives them an opportunity to be transformational in their parenting, to take the very best of what they experienced as children from their caregivers and keep it, and to jettison the parts that they felt really what might have been harmful, and to sort through all the other stuff. Now, I know as a parent myself of now two grown children, I remember simultaneously having that excitement, but then the real world set in, and I basically was in the second phase of the monomyth, which is what Campbell calls his model, which is a refusal of the call. And in the case of being a parent, refusal of the call means let me do things the way they were done to me, without much analysis, without much reflection, without much holding of myself personally accountable. Let me make projections onto my spouse parallel to the projections I saw my same-sex parent project onto the other parent, et cetera, et cetera. So that's sort of how those two steps might play out in a family with regard to the parents. But, of course, with the children, what you can easily do is slip over into these Ericksonian stages. And these first three stages really have to do with sort of engaging in the adventure of life from the very beginning. And then depending on how you're parented and what the context is, you may refuse the call. So I would argue that engaging in mistrust versus trust is a call refusal, maybe not of your making, but that's one way to think about it. I think that in the toddler stage of autonomy versus shame and doubt, when the child moves to shame and doubt, that's refusing the call of autonomy. And I would argue that in the preschool stage, which is initiative versus guilt, instead of engaging in initiative, getting things done, making things happen, refusal of the call of that stage would be to lapse into guilt instead of engaging in initiative.
Marty, as you were talking, I thought I'd just come in with a couple of other research-based models. As you were speaking, I thought a bit about self-efficacy theory from Van Durum. Mm-hmm. The more confidence that people have in their abilities to be autonomous, the more self-efficacy they probably develop. And then I also thought of the person-centered approach by Carl Rogers, the more genuineness, regard, and empathy that children and all of us experience, the more likely it is that we're probably going to answer more calls. So I thought I'd just share that with you and see where it takes us.
I also think that you put your finger on something that is an important aspect of parents having a call to adventure. So the genuineness, positive regard, and empathy are, I think, calling parents to be their best selves and to be their most effective parents. And yet we live in a world where genuineness, positive regard, and empathy are often in short supply. There are often few role models or insufficient role models. And so I think we can often walk away from being our best selves, which is what I think the GREs represent, and thereby we're refusing the call of being the parents we could be.
Marty, I have a question for you that came to mind here, and it's related, and you can ignore it if you don't think it's relevant. But what strikes me is that unlike education, I don't think there is any formal training on how to be a parent. And I don't know that that's often discussed, and most parents that I know get their ideas of what it means to be a parent through role models, and that's very different. Do you have any thoughts about that, maybe?
Yeah, so I agree with you. I think that's true. As my wife said, you know, there's no test in the Lamaze class, and maybe there should be. I do think many of us do get our parenting wisdom just sort of by vicarious learning, vicarious conditioning. But I also want to say that in the last 40 or 50 years, psychologists and other behavioral scientists have actually done a tremendous amount of work on empirically supported, effective approaches to parenting. And so we know some basic principles are supported pretty clearly. And so, yes, I agree with you that most of us learn our parenting by saying, oh, what do my parents do? Or even worse, I don't know if worse is the right way, but even more startling, we just sort of have automaticity. We just, something happens, and then what leaps out of us is a behavior that's eerily familiar to us because it's what our parents did to us without much more analysis. But the truth is, behavioral science has provided some very useful information about effective parenting. And so I think it's important for us to pay attention to that. One simple example of which is punishment works much less effectively than rewarding positive target behavior and distracting children away from suboptimal behavior. It's very, very clear that how quickly we learn, what the side effects are, and so forth, hugely favor catching our children doing something well rather than punishing them for doing something bad. And except for when it's a case of life and limb, letting dysfunctional behavior play out and have its own natural consequences is a much easier pathway to extinguishing dysfunctional behavior than punishment. Those are two of the principles that have been pretty clearly established in the behavioral science of parenting.
And Bern, one thing I want to jump on your idea of training, you know, parental training. One of the things that, or one of the courses that I've taught over the years is developmental psychology. And I know that these podcasts are about not only talking about these ideas and theories, but also giving practical steps that people would take if they want to journey into excellence. And one of the things that I recommend is that people either take or even audit a developmental psychology course, because it goes through all kinds of different things in terms of the science of helping young people to grow into these kinds of people who will answer the call to becoming excellent. So I thought I'd just throw that in there and see where it took us.
Well, Brian, that actually ties into the last thing I would throw into there is a relevant question for me now. As Marty says, there's a lot known. You know, as evidence in what effective parenting is. And so now the question comes up for me is, how do we start to get that out into the world where it makes a difference, as opposed to being, let's say, in the hallowed halls of academia, where it's important to learn things, but where it really makes a difference in the society is where most people go out into the world and don't wind up living their lives in academia. They go out like Jack and John, nothing against Marty and Brian, but they go out into the world, they have their families, they interact in their communities, and I think that's an important consideration, and with that, I'll shut up.
Yeah, I think that moves us a bit into the education system, so I'll go there and then bounce it all over to Jack and John. One of my
I was thinking about you, Brian.
Oh, thank you, yeah. One of my critiques of many educational systems is that it does not actually set people up to answer the call to excellence in terms of applying this stuff. And so I think one of the things that we need to do within education systems, and I kind of have one foot both in Marty's world and Jack and John's world, because as you mentioned in the intro, I also run a company where I go out and into organizations and talk with people about this stuff, is structuring your classroom so that people don't just learn this stuff or they don't just know this stuff, but they actually do this stuff. And one of the terms that came up in business a lot that I bring up a lot in both education and business is crossing the knowing-doing gap. And I think a lot of what education does is it gets people to believe that if they just know something, then they have succeeded. And so I think a lot of what we can do is structure courses so that people don't just know things, but they actually have to do things in order to get some of these higher grades. So that's one of the comments that, or one of the thoughts that came to my mind is for people that actually, and educators, to actually study different kinds of models like the stages of life change from Prochaska, Norcross, and DiClemente and Norcross. Where they actually help people to move from just contemplating change or just knowing about changes to actually preparing for action. And one of the linchpins, I think, between knowing and doing is the development of SMART goals. So in my class, all my classes, and then in all of my, most of my organizational trainings, we talk a bit about the vision, we talk a bit about the theory, and then we move right into the development of SMART goals, which is something that I've talked a lot with John and Jack and Marty about as well. Specific, measurable, agreed upon, realistic, and time-bound methods of moving from what you know to what it is that you actually do. So one of the, I guess, another practical thing that I'll talk about in business and education and in parenting is don't just go and know about this stuff, but every time you go and learn about something that you think would be good, create a SMART goal that helps you to actually change your life. And we might dig deeper into SMART goal development if you all want. But what I'd like to do now is toss it over to John and see if he has any thoughts on what we're talking about in terms of how this stuff plays out in the business world.
Yeah, I've been listening real carefully, and there's three things that come to mind, which is, I'm not a parent. I don't have children, so I can't speak to that too much, but I do feel that at some level, leading an organization and leading people is at some level parenting them and helping them grow. A couple things that I'm seeing really big right now in business. There's some new Google research on this, and I've been watching it with my clients. It used to be when we talk about building culture, there were three areas, and this is going to go right to what Brian and Marty just said, that I would focus on, which was safety, belongingness, and appreciation, that my ideas are safe, I'm emotionally safe, I'm physically safe, I'm part of the tribe, part of the family, good way to put it, part of the family, people love me here, and they genuinely appreciate the work I do, what I contribute to the organization. And for years, those were the three things I focused on. But based on some new research and new things I'm seeing, I've now switched it to or added to it safe, stability, dignity, and purpose. And again, this comes from a massive Google research study. Stability, in an uncertain world with lots of things going on, technology changing fast, geopolitical things, on and on and on and on. People, millennials and Gen Z, people at all ages are looking for some sort of consistency and stability. I see that pretty close to safety. Stability and safety seem close to the D, which is the one that I'm really interested in sharing with you guys, is dignity. And the fascinating thing about dignity is you can't, at least as far as I understand, you can't give someone dignity. What you give them is trust, empowerment, and autonomy. And then sort of, Brian, as you said it, they get a feeling of self-efficacy, and that self-efficacy allows them to feel dignity, and then they go treat other people with trust, respect, autonomy, empowerment. And then the last one, which has become very big, and this speaks too to the hero's journey, is a purpose. And this, I see this in more and more companies now, where they've replaced sort of the vision, mission, values sort of a thing with this is the purpose, the noble purpose that we are serving as an organization, to let people know that this is more than just a job. It's almost a calling, and that I'm not just making money, but I'm making a difference in the world. And it is something heroic that I'm trying to achieve. And then the last thing I'll say, and then we'll let Jack jump in here, is I'm also seeing it, and it goes back to one of the things we were just talking about, huge push in a lot of client companies I'm working with for safety to be vulnerable, safety to speak with candor, safety to bring up issues or bring up ideas without being attacked. And I've got three CEOs right now that I'm working with that all tell me I'm trying to create a culture of safety where people feel like they can be themselves and speak their truth and bring their diverse ideas to the table, and they won't be humiliated or attacked or embarrassed. So those are the three things I look: safety, belongingness, appreciation, stability, dignity, and purpose, and then creating a safe environment. Both physically, mentally, and emotionally. Don't all talk at once.
Jack.
Well, I'm listening to all of this, and I'm trying to figure out where I can get a handle on something that I can contribute that is worthwhile. And I'm going to go back to something that I wrote down in my notes all the way back when you started talking about the separation from the norm, and maybe try to tie it back to what John was talking about safety to be vulnerable. The whole phrase, a hero's journey, I guess is demands that the person living that story has to be a hero, and being a hero is not safe. So, right?
Good point. Very good point.
And
that's why the pioneers have all the arrows in their back.
And I feel where we need heroes today is that there are so many organizations where everybody wants conformity to the organization's goals, whether it's the stock price, whether it's the party line, whether it's loyalty to an individual who wants nothing but loyalty. And it takes a tremendous amount of courage to be a hero and to separate from that. And I'm thinking about whistleblowers, whether in politics or in companies, because they've been in the news a lot lately. And there's something that I believe John left out, those six words that you gave, because there's another reason that, at least for some people, that is very important to them, and that's autonomy. Where you have to feel like you're in control of your own destiny, you're in control of your own integrity. Regardless of what culture you live in, you have a culture that maybe you grew up with or that you internalized somehow that you need to live up to. And when you're out of sorts with the organization, no matter how much, and there's many times I've been in organizations where everybody talks about safety and it's okay to disagree, but personally, I don't believe it. I see the little micro expressions that the leader has when somebody says something, and I just don't believe it. So if we're talking about a hero's journey, we have to realize, first of all, is it for everybody? Does everybody have to live their life being a hero? Because if you're going to be a hero, you're going to take a lot of shots and you're not always going to win. And the thing about danger is that, there's not always a happy ending.
Jack, as you were speaking, I was thinking of the other component that I wanted to cover today, and that is refusal of the call. So is there, there is this call to adventure, and I'll give away this whole hero's journey, the end of the hero's journey, according to Campbell and I think some of these scientific models that align with it, is the freedom to live as you wish to live. And so that's at the end of the return stuff, okay? And as you said, that is very dangerous, to live as you wish to live. And I think part of the refusal of the call has to do with fear of danger. And I think it also has to do with these powerful forces of compliance, conformity, and obedience. And I often talk about compliance, conformity, and obedience being, in some cases, the opposite of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit. And Marty alluded a little bit to that, I think, when he was speaking about people who just sort of parent the way that they were parented. I think there's some compliance, conformity, and or obedience in that. But maybe we should talk a little bit about the difference between saying that people are safe here and they're free here and we want people to be vulnerable, and actually setting up an environment where people can do those things. And that, to me, from the leadership perspective. And then I think from the non-leadership perspective, whether it's children or students or employees, I think we need to get to another word that you said and that Marty and I talked about, and that is cultivation of courage. So I'll just throw that out there and see if any of you all have anything you want to say about any of that.
So I wanted to jump in and move back just a teeny bit to two things, and then I want to move. Then I think it's great for us to move forward. The first one is, John Spence did actually, Jack, talk about autonomy. What he argued is that dignity is the consequence of a person being in an environment where trust, power, and autonomy are present appropriately, and then from that the person derives this sense of dignity. The dignity can't be directly provided, but autonomy was one of the things John said was part of the secret sauce, the result of which is that a person experiences, for example, dignity in the workplace. So that's one thing I wanted to throw in there. And the second thing I wanted to throw in there is I want to open up the idea that the hero's journey is actually for everyone. And the reason that I want to raise that, and I'm certainly open to people disagreeing, is that when I look back at Erikson's stages of psychosocial development, the final stage, the stage that my parents, who are in their 90s, are in, is called integrity versus despair. And it's characterized as when someone reflects on his or her life, now that one is at the end of it or near the end of it, the older adult can feel a sense of satisfaction with what happened or failure and regret about what happened. And I would argue that what makes someone a hero is that at the end of one's life, one feels a sense of integrity about that life rather than despair. And so in that sense, I would want to invite everyone to be, in that particular definition, a hero.
Marty, can I jump in
here? Yeah, I think that's something. Go ahead. Vern, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, as I listen to you, Marty, really what you're saying to me is a hero's journey is really a life's journey as we step into life. And you started to talk about people coming to the end of their life, being the oldest one on this panel. I'm probably closer to the end than the rest of you, all things being equal. And I wrote something down not that long ago that I shared with my brother that I think is important. And what I shared was, by the measures and standards of many, I might not be considered successful. This being said, I've lived the life I wanted.
Exactly.
And I don't know what to say about that, but I do want to add something else as we go on. Two other things. We're talking about a hero's journey. I think it's useful to talk about what constitutes a hero. And one of the notes that I wrote down here was, where does fear enter into this definition of hero? And the other thing is maybe a little bit more tangential, but one of the things that I've come to be deeply appreciative of personally is I think that adults in many respects are missing in the lives of the youth today, primarily manifested by the fact adults criticize the youth of today. And I've taken it upon myself every time I'm in the presence of young people, whether it be at a restaurant and someone serving me, to tell the youth that serve me that I'm in good hands. I really appreciate you're doing a good job. I appreciate you. And it's amazing to me. I was on a walk yesterday. There were some young guys installing some telephone lines or something. And I says, keep up the good work. I really appreciate it. I know I'm in good hands with you. And they were all appreciative. And I think that often for people of my age anyway, not you guys, because you guys aren't like that, is we don't credit the youth and show them the appreciation they deserve. There's no leadership there. Anyway, I'll leave it with that.
So, Vern, I'll just jump in real quickly and talk a little bit about some of the scientific models that map onto what you said and then toss it back to everybody else. Some of the models that came to my mind as you were speaking about the importance of showing appreciation to other people made me think, again, of self-efficacy theory, encouraging self-efficacy. As John said, part of that has to do with reinforcing the good, and Marty alluded to that in the family system as well. And then also the person-centered approach back to Carl Rogers and genuineness, regard, and empathy. A lot of research behind how well that can help people to learn, change, and grow when people exhibit those attitudes in a pretty straightforward way. And I think a lot of that maps on to the Ericksonian approach that Marty's been speaking about as well. So maybe I'll toss it on over to Marty and see if he sees anything that relates to Erickson when it comes to older generation people, not just criticizing youth, but also pointing out to them when they think they're doing a great job.
Yeah, so I just have a couple of little bits. The first one is that in my experience, what Vern is doing is a delightful exception to what I think is otherwise a more dismal rule. And I have no empirical evidence for this, but I do experience that each generation finds a reason to criticize the younger generation. And when I hear people's narratives about these various different generations that we've labeled Gen X, Millennial, Baby Boomer, all, et cetera, it seems like it is mostly a license for empirically unsubstantiatable bigotry. And yet I know that people deeply engage in this, and most of the narratives that I hear, now other people may hear different narratives, and I'd love to hear that, but most of the narratives I hear are basically in service of in-grouping the generation that particular person is in and mm-hmm. out-grouping or denigrating some other generation. And so I love that Vern is running against that tendency and trying to embrace a group of people who are different in age from him and lift them up. My sense is, although I don't have an empirical foundation for it, my sense is that all too often what we tend to do is engage in ageist behavior. We tend to take all the members of a particular age group and say they have a common fate, typically a common set of flaws or limits, which is empirically probably not substantiatable.
Hey, what do you
think? And Marty, I'll just say that takes me back to some of our early podcasts last year into logical fallacies. And I think about the fallacy of overgeneralization, and the genetic fallacy whenever I think of people saying, well, all of these people from this particular age group are all this, that, or the other thing. So I guess I'm hearkening back to the need to liberate oneself from fallacies if you're going to take the heroic journey into excellence.
And just one thing I want to throw in on that. I believe that any time that you downgrade somebody, or even whether you – upgrade them based on their age or some category that they fit into, you're taking away their personal dignity, because you're not seeing them necessarily as a person. You're seeing them as a representative of a group, as a concept, but not as a real person. And I think that takes away dignity as well.
Yep.
John, yeah, you want to weigh in? I'm really interested in this because you do motivational speaking and you speak to people in business who ultimately hire young people. And this whole notion of hero's journey, life is a journey. And as I said, I think the call to the hero's journey is really a call to life. And part of being called to life is facing our fears. And one of the things that strikes me about the true hero, when you talk to people that are considered heroes, is they don't see themselves as heroes. They're merely people that rose to the occasion in the presence of whatever fear accompanied their action. So I'm interested in what my business people have to say about that.
Well, it's
and my psychologists.
Well played. As everybody was talking, I was thinking about something I've come up against with. Right now, I'm coaching four CEOs, all of them running $100 million or billion-dollar companies, multi-billion-dollar companies, and every one of them has the same thing I had when I was running a large organization, and still have today. Jack suffers from this horribly, but he has a right to. It's called imposter syndrome. And
I knew those words
well
were
done.
Coming out of your mouth at the beginning of your paragraph.
Well done.
In all seriousness. You know, and, you know, Jack, I recall you and I many, many years ago when we got in that car and we were singing the, oh, we're so important,
yeah.
Big control.
Yeah.
And realizing that people actually listen to us. And I enter my 20th year teaching at Wharton this year, and I look back and say, they hired me when I was 35. That was a serious error in judgment. it's funny because I still suffer for this. I'm sure all of us on the phone do, but it's interesting for me that I see people who other people would see as heroes and leaders and courageous running multi-billion-dollar companies who lay awake at night saying, what happens when they figure out I have no idea what I'm doing? So kind of to you, Vern, is it's interesting that even those who are leading what we would consider some level of a heroic journey, leading other people, sometimes hundreds or thousands, feel lonely, scared, and incompetent, even though there is tons of evidence that they're doing a very good job and achieving at a high level.
Yep.
That's why
I think that's one reason that heroes don't always see themselves as heroes, because they're afraid of something that may be in their minds much bigger than the danger that everybody else sees.
Yeah, I think that what a lot of people, I guess we should go back to operational definitions. You know, last year we defined excellence as being helpful to ourselves and others. And I think a lot of times people define heroes as these big, huge, fearless people. And that's really not what the hero's journey is about. It's really not what I think being helpful to ourselves and others is about. John mentioned vulnerability. And if you are scared of nothing, then I think almost by definition, you don't deal with vulnerability. And you probably won't know how to promote it. So I think it's probably important to again, kind of dig back into what does it mean to be excellent and what does it mean to pursue excellence in a heroic way. And for me, I don't think at all it has to do with being fearless. And I know there are a lot of leadership models out there that say, hey, you must be fearless. But actually what we found psychologically is that people without fear are much more likely to be psychopathic than they are to be heroic.
Yeah.
So we might want to put that out there as well. Fear is a part, as Jack said, of the hero's journey. If you're taking a journey where you don't fear anything, I think you're either your nervous system is set up to perhaps be a psychopath, or you're probably not really answering the hero's call, because it is the hero's journey does include danger. And we'll talk a little bit later when we get into the initiation phase about all the dangers that are involved in heroism. And I think we need to get back to, instead of the fearless idea, which I don't think is useful and typically not accurate, as John said, when you get behind the mask of some of these folks and when you get behind our own mask, but talk about how can you be courageous in the face of very fearsome ideas, including being somebody who is running these multi-billion dollar corporations with thousands and thousands of people who are hanging on their every word.
Yeah, and one thing that I want to throw in, it's a little bit off on a tangent, but we threw out the word earlier about being genuine. Sometimes being genuine, if you're a leader, is the last thing that you want to do. Because if you're feeling like an imposter, or you're feeling like the course that you're trying to get everybody to get behind is probably not going to work, or you're afraid of it, you're going to communicate that fear unless you hide it, unless you show complete confidence. So you can't be genuine when you're taking a hero's journey.
Now, that's interesting, because I think that idea, Jack, flies in the face of vulnerability, because to me, part of vulnerability is communicating to people, hey, I don't know how this is going to work out.
Well, and it does fly in the face of it. Vulnerability, like anything else, has its place when it is the right thing to do, but there are times that vulnerability is the last thing that you want.
I'd like to delve into that. I'm interested in that.
So there is this interesting function in the brain that is critical to social behavior, and it is the idea that we have emotional contagion. We even have a set of neurons that are sort of devoted to this called mirror neurons, which basically create social behavior by allowing one human to catch, catch the emotion of the other person. And so if, for example, you're a leader who's in close proximity with those you lead, it's pretty unlikely that you could effectively pull off appearing to have no fears or concerns at all without somehow that your real fears and concerns being at some neural level being transmitted and reflected in the experience of those around you. So that's one of the endemic challenges.
Yeah, I have to push back on that, because people fool people all the time. A lot of people get fooled by leaders, good leaders and bad leaders.
I think the more distant you are from them, the more that's true. I think the more you're in the same physical space, close social proximity. Yeah.
And a lot of leaders, especially the higher up you go, the more distant you're going to be from your followers.
Maybe that's why.
If you run a billion-dollar company, you've probably got 5,000 employees plus, and you're not going to be in front of them all the time, but you still have to exert leadership. And let me give you a historical example, which I do on occasion. You're all familiar with Churchill's famous speech where he said, we'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on the landing grounds, we'll fight them in the fields and in the streets. As soon as he turned off that radio broadcast, he turned and said to somebody who was sitting in there, he said, and we'll hit him over the head with bloody broken bottles, because that's bloody well all we've got. So he knew that if the Germans actually did invade at that time, that it would have been all over, because there was nothing left. After they evacuated Dunkirk, they had nothing left. No heavy weapons or anything like that. But the last thing he's going to do is tell people, hey, we're extremely vulnerable, and you're not going to show vulnerability sometimes when resolution is called for.
You know, that's interesting, Jack, because I've heard of speeches as well, and you remember these things much better than I do, that do sort of, acknowledge vulnerability. The sort of speeches from certain leaders, maybe from other cultures, where they talk about, actually Joseph Campbell mentioned this in some of his speeches, that today is a good day to die, which basically that basically says, look, we're going out into a very scary battle, everybody, and if we die, it's a good day to do it. So I think this is a really
interesting topic. Yeah, but they didn't say, and I'm afraid of dying. Today is a good day to die is not the same thing as saying, oh my God, we're all going to die.
Yes, that's true. And I think as you're speaking, Jack, I'm thinking back into the Eric Erickson model that Marty brought up because, and I'll just throw this out. I don't know where this is going to go. I haven't thought about this before in quite this way. But what Erickson basically said is that there are these different stages, and if you get the right sort of mentoring and experiences, that you get these particular outcomes. And Marty, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of the outcomes are things like security and independence and a feeling of powerfulness, a feeling of goodness, a feeling of love, a feeling of belongingness. These are all things that at the much of it, I think, gets cultivated in higher functioning families at the family level. And I'm just kind of playing around with this with you all on the fly. My guess is that if we get more parents journeying into more evidence-based excellence in parenting, that I think vulnerability and genuineness, no matter what the topic, will actually be more motivating than putting up some sort of a mask. And I think Carl Rogers did quite a bit of research on that very thing, that vulnerability, although some people think if you express being afraid or some of these quote-unquote demotivating emotions. But if you do express those things in certain contexts with certain people at certain times, it's actually more motivating than putting up a mask and saying, I'm fearless.
And I'm not talking about saying I'm fearless.
Yeah,
I'm not talking about saying I'm fearless. It's okay to show vulnerability and say, I'm just as scared as the rest of you. But you can also say something like, but I'm confident in our strategy, or I'm confident in our capabilities, and I know we can do that.
Yeah.
So a mixture of vulnerability with some way out. You've got to give people some way out. Otherwise, you destroy their own sense of self-efficacy, and then you haven't done anybody any good.
And I would say if you can't do that, Jack, that you probably haven't done the second phase of the hero's journey, the initiation, well enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you've risen to a level where you can't say, hey, this is scary. I know we're a billion-dollar company. We could lose it all. But I've got enough expertise to know that we're going in here with a strategy that I feel really good about.
Right.
And so I think that kind of plays into the second phase of the hero's journey, and that is doing the work to become somebody who has actually earned the position of leadership.
I'm going to jump in here for a second, guys. And Brian, I know you're about to go to the next phase, but I'm going to just share an anecdote with you all. It's been both in my career when I've had to run organizations and in working with people leading other organizations, it's always been fascinating to me to see this, pivotal point where all of a sudden they decide, all right, I'm going forward. You know, I've hesitated, I've worried about it a little bit. This is a big, big risk I'm about to take. And I call it putting a stake in the ground. It's like, boom, okay.
Mm-hmm.
From now on, this is the way it's going. We're going to climb this mountain. We're going to do this, or I'm going to refuse to tolerate this sort of thing, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched them hesitate up to the very minute. And me as well, when you say, I'm about to make a big, bold bet, and Jack sort of knew, I'm scared and I'm worried. But when I walk out this door, I'm going to clearly show people that I've thought this through and I feel confident about the direction we're going in. It's going to be challenging. It's going to be scary, dangerous, potentially dangerous. But I still am confident that we're moving in the right direction together. And I just had a CEO today make a major strategy decision for his organization, a make or break, frankly, at the billion-dollar level, and finally the epiphany just came and said, got it. Okay, I got it now. I'm ready to go. And I thought, how fascinating it was to watch him for 2 months get ready to make that decision.
So,
Go ahead, Vern.
Yeah, John, you bring up something that I think is interesting. I want to throw in the mix that ties into this as far as I'm concerned. Is commitment there. There's the William Hutchison Murray quote that says, until one is committed, there's hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. And he goes on to say that once one is committed, one steps into it. And I think that one of the things that may separate heroes from non-heroes is in the face of fear, they're committed to the outcome. I got thinking back to one we had last year where we were talking about Hal Moore and Plumlee. And what made me think about that is Hal Moore was considered a hero, but even heroes have those people that support them, like Plumlee, his confidence. And that's important if you don't do the hero's journey alone, it seems to me. And when Hal Moore said to Plumlee, like Custer, we're in a terrible situation here, kind of like we're going to lose, I'm going to do it the nice way, folks.
What did Plumlee say?
You're no General Custer, sir. you have what it takes to get the job done. He didn't. And for those of you that
and for those of you
podcast,
who are interested in that scene, I urge you to watch the movie.
But that, you know, there you just said that, John, is that commitment does a lot. The other one that came up to mind was the CEO of FedEx when it was a fledgling company that took the last of their funds and went to Las Vegas to gamble because they couldn't make payroll. And I'm not suggesting that people should do that, but one question about that from the board of directors, what he said was, we were lost anyway. If something didn't happen, we're going under anyhow. And as it turns out, he did win. They made payroll, and FedEx is a big thing. So I just throw that out there.
What that
one of the
me,
things that came to my mind, I'm sort of representing some of the scientific models that I think undergird a lot of what these stories represent, is Clara Hill's Exploration Insight Action Model. That's what I was thinking about, John, when you were talking about these phases that people tend to go through. And according to this model, if you don't go through these phases, then you end up making regretful decisions. What Clara Hill found is that exploration is the first step in all of this. So you take enough time to explore as many possibilities as you possibly can. And I think this gets again into the next phase of the hero's journey, the initiation phase. I think the more that you learn and the more that you know about your field, the more possibilities you can explore. So first there's this exploration stage that wise decision makers tend to go through according to Hill's model. Then there's the insight stage where you take some time to really let all of those things marinate. It's not a fast or a quick decision. And then only after you explore multiple different possibilities and then you take some time to really let them marinate, do you launch into action. And what Hill and others have found is that people who do that at a proper pace, not too slow, not too fast, eventually get to the point, I think, that you described, John, which is where you say, look, there's still fear, nothing's guaranteed, but I feel really good now about this course of action. And the more expertise or the more initiation that you go through, I think the more likely it is that you're going to have a good chance of making a good decision.
So I had a couple of thoughts about this as well, one of which is, in addition to Clara Hill's model, I think that Prochaska Di Clemente's stages of change is a nice overlay, because you have the pre-contemplation stage, you're not sure there's a problem, contemplation stage, which is where I think John was saying that these executives are spending a lot of time, and then that transitions into the preparation stage. That's where you put your stake in the ground and say, we're doing this. And that paves the way for the action stage, where the organization actually is going to move in a very different direction. What I was going to argue is I think that declaration that John talked about is an example of courage. It's an example of fear being overcome by the commitment to action in spite of the fear. And so it to me, courage, just as you were mentioning earlier, Brian, courage is a critical element in the hero's journey, and it's a critical element in being a good leader. So it's not the absence of fear. It is the ability to embrace both fear and commit to the action that is the contemplation of which has invoked the fear.
I just have a question. I think all these models are wonderful. But the models seem like they take time for the person to be initiated to get to the point where they're ready to take effective and committed action. What about a crisis situation? What if you are the CEO of Boeing and a plane crashes and all this stuff comes out? You don't have time to go through an initiation process. You have to react. You have to take action first. It may not be the right action, but, you know, you've got to do something. So how does that fit into the model?
I think it all depends on how deeply you believe in have to. So the truth is that there are external elements, rewards and punishers, that may entice somebody to engage in immediate action rather than than thoughtfully walking through the stages. And there are costs and benefits to skipping the stages of change and acting instantly, and their costs and benefits to frustrating your context or your environment or your public or your stakeholders, but going through the process with integrity. I think it just, those are both realities. It's a mismatch between this perceived demands of the situation and the internal process of the person. And the truth is, as humans, we face this all the time, that our internal processes and the demands of the external environment sometimes map onto each other beautifully. Sometimes I'm moving more slowly than the environment wants, and sometimes I'm moving more quickly than the environment wants. It's just the nature of living in a social world.
And I have two thoughts that popped up when you asked that. Vern, I'll just put this out there real quick and then go to you. But the first one came from the expertise literature, and you may already know this, but one of the major differences between novices and experts is that experts have been so initiated into so many different things that they don't necessarily make better decisions sometimes than novices, but they make them more quickly. And so I'll just use the sort of metaphor of chess. They found that chess players, as they become more and more expert, are able to make chess moves even in quote-unquote sort of crisis situations. And I know this isn't the same as a crashing plane, you know, but maybe psychologically it's in the same ballpark. Let's say your opponent makes a move that you've never seen before that you weren't expecting, and you've got to make a move relatively quickly. The more expertise you have, the more likely it is that you'll make a decent move even in the face of some kind of unexpected move from somebody else. And then the other thing I was thinking about has to do with our commitment to providing our listeners with practical things that they can do in order to take this hero's journey. And one thing that I recommend to people in family systems and education systems and in leadership systems is some kind of regular relaxation routine. Because I think a lot of these quote-unquote crisis situations to somebody who hasn't actually been initiated into being able to focus and center can cause people to make regretful decisions. So, and I think even at a physiological level, your nervous system to somebody who hasn't been initiated into methods of calming the nervous system can cause you sometimes to, I think, mislabel crises as something that needs to be done or something where you need to do something immediately. Whereas if you have some kind of routine that helps you to relax and focus, you start to see, well, wait a minute, this actually requires a very thoughtful response, and so I don't have to react. I can instead respond. And there's a lot of good data on what regular relaxation does to the mind. I think there's I'm not a complete expert at this, but I believe it's alpha waves that are correlated with more creativity. And so people who are able to respond to crises with relaxation, I think there's good data to indicate that you might be somebody who not only makes less regretful decisions, but that you might actually be able to access the creative parts of your brain much more easily and effectively as well. Vern, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say to Jack that maybe a way to look at it that could be useful is there are such things as heroic actions that occur along the way of a heroic journey, a hero's journey. And clearly there's I'm aligned with you in a lot of respects, Jack, that there's a lot there's where the theory and where the rubber meets the road. And part of what seems to be missing a lot of times with us as humans is integrating the two. And as Brian just pointed out, there is that is one becomes more aware of the underpinnings of how things work, one is more effective in one's actions and stuff. But you're absolutely right. Is the guy that's out there in the field? It's like the Theodore Roosevelt quote we've done before. You know, everyone can criticize the action of the guy in the ring, but it's the guy that's swinging, blocking, and getting his nose bloodied in the action that's the ultimate hero. Being a hero is being engaged in the game, and I think that's very important to realize. And so those were my comments on that.
I wanted to go back to the Boeing thing because the truth is that I don't understand this crisis nearly as much as you do, but as a sort of just a regular consumer of the Boeing crisis, the sense I got is that there were spasmodic, quick decisions that were made and implemented it by the organization at several different steps along the way that ultimately weren't completely effective or successful, and then that has given way to a more thoughtful, painful, contemplative, costly, and perhaps necessary set of processes that now are leading to more fundamental questions about, for example, whether this notion of having software to correct for the problem of putting different engines on a fuselage designed for other engines is really a smart long-term strategy or not. I mean, going much more fundamental and basic. So, and again, I'm no expert on this, and I'm delighted to be corrected if I've made misstatements of fact or mischaracterized things. But my sense of this from the beginning is that perhaps slowing down and not yielding to pressure from stakeholders like stock share members or board members or the public or the media or whomever, maybe ignoring a little of that might have led to a better long-term set of decisions than what I think has happened.
I think you're right. I just can't imagine any human being strong enough to withstand the kind of pressure that they must have been under. You've got shareholders, you've got your largest customers are saying, we're losing millions of dollars a day. When are you going to get these planes back in the air?
You've got
the media.
You've got Airbus saying, oh, we can take those contracts.
Yeah, you've got the media all over you. So I'm not criticizing them because I can imagine the pressure that they must have been under. Unfortunately, what I think they reacted when you're under so much pressure, you go back to your first instinct. And his first instinct was basically to protect the company by not telling the truth. You know, they originally
yeah.
said, oh, well, it's an easy fix. We'll get this fixed within a few weeks. And then that became harder and harder. And now I think I read today that it's going to be probably the summer. So it'll end up being at least a year before this whole thing could happen. And part of that, too, goes back to your point about expertise, Brian. Experts tend to make quick decisions because they've seen it before and they consider fewer options than non-experts.
Right.
But that works for them when they're in a familiar situation.
Yes.
But when experts are confronted with something totally unfamiliar, sometimes their expertise can be a drag on them because
yeah.
they're seeing things through a lens that they've gone their whole life learning. And I learned this way back in 1989. I was getting a master's degree in Soviet studies at the University of Miami. And this is right when the perestroika and the glasnost and everything was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And my professors were all scrambling to explain this in a way that accorded with their view of the world, which is this is all a trick. And somehow they're trying to put one over on us.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that I was smarter than them. I wasn't. I knew a lot less than they did. I was just listening to them, and they're saying, no, this is not going to work. This is all a trick. You know, the Soviet Union is not going anywhere. Their whole basis of expertise no longer fit in a changed environment.
As we're talking about all these different things, I'm thinking about the component of refusal of the call within
mm-hmm.
that separation phase, because refusal of the call, the way that Campbell thought about it, and I think it really maps on nicely to the way that we're talking about it, and your, I think, reasonable skepticism, Jack, of some of John's statements about people trying to, CEOs trying to make a safer, more vulnerable, open organization, and you came in and said, well, I don't tend to believe that because there are all these forces. I think this is all around that second stage of refusal of the call, and one of the main components that Campbell pointed out that I think is right at the center of what we're talking about is fear, that you refuse the call to civility, to clear thinking, to openness, to genuineness, because you're afraid. And I think part of what my suggestion was about regular sort of calming and relaxation expertise relates to this, and I think it relates to the hero's journey, because when I think about expertise in terms of the hero's journey, I immediately think about fear management, because as you said, Jack, the hero's journey is oftentimes a very scary journey. And there's lots of research into people who do become eventually experts at calming their central nervous system. One of the things that I just came across this past week was, I think it was Jacobson, somebody was doing research on somebody who got into such a relaxed state that a big, loud noise that made everybody do an automatic startle response resulted in no response from this person. So I thought it might be good to talk a little bit more about refusal of the call and how that relates to not becoming initiated into becoming an expert at fear management and see where that took us.
Before we do that, let me do something here real quick. Since John is rarely with us, he's a special guest. I'd like to get some more thoughts for him, and I want to open up with something I find intriguing. John, have you been on a hero's journey? Has your life been a hero's journey? Why and or why not? And what would you tell people that are entering this journey, young, middle-aged, and old?
Well, that's a really tough question, Vern, because I guess at some stages, all of us on the line here have pursued challenging situations, and in times that I've had to lead companies or help companies make very, very big decisions, I think there's been some level of pursuing a hero's journey. I'm going to be very authentic and vulnerable, Jack.
Jack, just to say that Jack recommends against it, John.
Yeah, I know.
No, I only recommend it when you're in a leadership position. Right now, we're among friends. at least we were when we started this conversation.
I kind of feel at this point that I'm coasting and just trying to work on my craft, and I don't know that I see a hero's journey in that part of my life other than trying to leave a legacy of some ideas and information that might help other people. And maybe that at some level is a hero's journey. But I will say that, you know, when I've run companies in the past and I used to lay awake at night and think about the couple hundred kids I had to put through college, it felt more heroic and like there was more at stake. But for the other people that are maybe taking this journey, I've learned it a couple of times in my life, is that idea of when you get to a point where you say, I'm going to do this, or I'm not going to do this, where you put that stake in the ground and say, I'm going to take this risk, or I'm going to risk rejection because I refuse to go down this path that doesn't match my values, and you put a lot at stake by making that decision, those are the times I've felt changed my life or crucibles. And I think for other people, it's pushing yourself to get to the point where you care about something enough and you're committed enough that you're willing to step past that level of fear and anxiety and into an unknown place, but to do it with courage and some level of grace and letting the people around you know that you're not perfect and you're not claiming you are, but you are the one who's willing to go out front and lead them, even if it means you might get hurt. Like for me, if running a company or the CEO I was talking today, you do this wrong, you lose your job. Now, losing your job isn't that bad. It's not the end of the world. But when you've wrapped up your persona and you've spent 30 years building a career and you make a wrong decision and there goes 30 years down the toilet, there's a lot at stake there too. So I would say find something that you're passionate enough about, that you're willing to commit to, and to take bold risks and follow that hero's journey. And I'm not sure what the next level of mine is. Who knows? So That was my feedback, Vern. Being very vulnerable, open, honest, transparent, and speaking with candor.
Hey, can I jump in real quick?
Yes.
On this one? I think, first of all, in John's answer, he may have been just suffering a little bit from potentially imposter syndrome. I'm gonna speak from the heart here for a second. I have seen John's hero's journey. So I think you're being you're selling yourself short. I literally met John on the first day that he embarked on his journey because he got hired into our company, and quite frankly, he didn't know what the hell he was doing.
I didn't. I had no damn idea what I was doing.
He did not. But I'll tell you what, I never saw anybody more committed to learning. I never saw anybody ask more questions. I never saw anybody read more books. He would highlight his books, and I used to laugh because I'd open one of his books, and like 80% of the stuff was highlighted, and 20% was not. I go, John, when highlight means that. But he literally learned this stuff. He worked on it. He was not afraid to try anything. And I know John took the next step in his hero's journey, not by choice. When we both ended up leaving the company that we were working for, and he went off and built a huge career for himself, all on his own. So you've been through that hero's journey. So don't suffer imposter syndrome. You've earned the right to coast.
Thanks, Donkey. A private joke.
And I'll sort of piggyback on that as well.
Thank you, Jack. That was very nice, my friend.
Oh, of course.
Oh, I'm so sorry, John. I talked to him.
And by the way, I was being genuine when I said that, guys.
No, he was. He was.
It came through.
Because we've already agreed that you're going to speak at my funeral if I go first. So I think you got a good framework started there.
Well, yeah, I've got the title now already. A Hero's Journey.
And you got the beginning. He didn't know what the hell he was doing.
Yep.
And I'll kind of piggyback on top of that. One of the things, again, the hero's journey from the Campbellian perspective is not, and this reminds me a little bit about what Vern said at the beginning of this about traditional ways of thinking about heroes and success. The hero's journey from this perspective is basically living the life you want to live. And helping other people to live the life that they want to live. And I sometimes summarize that with life, liberty, happiness pursuit. And one of the things that really affected me when I first met John, I think it's around 20 years ago now, is that he had figured out a way in which to, at least from my perspective, to live the life that he wanted to live. So to piggyback on top of what Jack just said, John, I think part of what makes you a hero from this model's perspective and from my perspective is your ability to make the life that you want. And it's something that I've always thought was one of the most heroic things about you.
Okay, let's get off me as a topic. It's not very interesting.
But I'd like to, John, I'd like to ask you a question, getting back to this refusal of the call because of fear.
Yeah.
And some of the things that I was talking about with Jack in terms of, I think the hero's journey, part of the initiation is becoming an expert fear manager. So I thought maybe I'd ask you to share with our listeners, what were some of the most fearsome things that you encountered in your life's journey, and what have you done to help you manage that fear? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'll give you probably one of the most challenging things I ever went through. It was early in my career when I worked for the Rockefellers. I had four billionaires on my board, and everybody else was worth $100 million. And I had a very aggressive boss at one point, and it was becoming extremely stressful for the entire staff. And I was basically the number two person there, so I was shielding the entire staff. I was taking the rage and the anger and all the blame, so that they didn't get totally wiped out. And I remember one of the most fearful things is the day that I said, I can't do this anymore. I would get up in the morning, I would shake putting on my clothes, and I would cry driving home in the evening. And when I finally said, I can't do this anymore, and I'm going to quit, but I'm going to leave, and here's what it is. I'm going to leave letting the board of directors know why I'm going, and I'm going to take all the heat to protect the rest of the company. I'm going to jump on the hand grenade. And I went to my entire senior
manager. John, how did you get the courage to do that? That's a courageous act. You're in the middle of shaking. Could you share with the viewers what did you do? Because a lot of times when people get to that shaking place, they refuse the call to heroism, and you were able to answer it. So how did you manage that shaking and turn it into a heroic event?
Well, I realized that if I didn't take care of myself, I'd never be able to take care of anybody else. The amount of stress I was under was really having a severe toll on my wife, my life and my marriage and everything else. But I decided that I would not let my people down. I would protect them even after I was gone, if possible. So I just decided I had to do this for myself, but I was going to go out making sure that I could do everything I could to take care of my folks. And I went to my senior management team and told them that I was going to do this, and I showed them the letter I was going to turn in to the board, which outlined everything and protected them. And this is a big turnaround for me. They all said they wanted to sign it too. Actually, every single person in the company except for one person signed on to the letter. And the one person said, I just got divorced. I'm a single mom. I have two kids. I can't lose this job. I can't sign it. She was just too scared. But every other person in the organization signed on to the letter. And it wasn't meant to be this way, but that's how I ended up becoming CEO at 26. Is they said, if it's this bad, then you hold the place down, and we'll find another CEO. The next CEO didn't work out, and I was named CEO. But I was willing to give all that up to protect myself and protect the team. And it turned out that everybody was courageous and wanted the same outcome, a positive outcome for all of us.
John, that's very powerful that you said as far as I'm concerned. And basically, in the hero's journey, a hero doesn't expect of others what they're not willing to accept for themselves and do for themselves. That's, you know, one of the things that I remember Alexander the Great, one of the battles he was in, as I heard on a show one time, was he routed defeat by inserting himself into the center of the battle.
John, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I knew I could rebuild my life, that losing a job wasn't that big of a deal, but I didn't want everybody else to get hurt. And I knew that if I took all the pain, that it would protect them, and I'd be able to figure out a way out of it on the other side. But it all turned out in a way that I never, ever would have imagined it would have turned out. So it was just an interesting journey.
John, as you were talking about how you overcame that fear and instead of refusing the call, you answered the call to heroism, I couldn't help but think of Viktor Frankl's work in his famous book, Man's Search for Meaning. And one of the things that he talked about is that if you can put some kind of meaning or connect with some kind of bigger vision, that you can handle a lot of distress and a lot of fear and that sort of thing. And it sounds like to me that the way that you managed that fear, that feeling that made you shake, was that you connected your actions with some kind of big heroic vision. Would that be a decent way to sort of summarize how you managed that fear?
Yeah, at some level. And you know, it's interesting, you guys, Jack, you're probably the same as me. I have a hard time even equating the word hero with anything I've ever done. replaced it with the word leadership, I would say yes, I took a leader's role and tried to do what I thought was best for everybody. And I knew that I'd be okay. And I was hoping too it would teach the other folks a lesson that your life and your happiness and your family are more important than a paycheck right now. And sometimes you've got to make really, really difficult decisions. But you have to make them, because otherwise the world will make them for you, and the world doesn't normally care too much about your outcome.
Marty, I have something that I want to ask you real quick, is that you've been generous in this series and sharing about your life. And since this whole series deals with family as well, would you share a little bit about your hero's journey, because you've been heroic in the face of family trials. What did it take to rise to the occasions and deal with some of the things you've had to deal with in your life?
So probably the biggest challenge of my adult life came from my oldest son. The day that he said to me, in fact, I'm sitting in the office where he said this. He walked into me and he said, "Dad, if you don't get help with your temper, I'm not going to have a relationship with you anymore." And that started a journey for me that in my own little way is heroic, of walking away from power, control, domination, abuse, and walking toward equality, listening, compromising, trusting other people. So I'd say the most heroic part of my life started in my 50s, not even in my early 50s. And I have worked very hard, been to therapy. I go to therapy every 3 weeks. I used to go every week of my life. I now go every 3 weeks. Ever since my son said that to me, we've rebuilt our relationship. I've improved my relationship with my younger son, my 10 years younger son, and we're close. The marriage, unfortunately, that I had with their mother is gone, and it's not recoverable. But that was the cost of me living on that power and control wheel too long. And but I have married another person, and that relationship is an equality wheel relationship, not a power and control relationship. And we have both worked to make sure that's true. So it's a little thing. It's a small corner of the world, and it's very local. But that's really the thing I'm sort of most proud of in my adult development, and it's occurred pretty recently. And in the process, it's actually also transformed my relationships with my two parents, who are now in their 90s. You can probably guess where I learned power and control from. It wasn't from TV, I can tell you that. And so I've been able to be a different person. And I think I've had, in a small way, an impact on both of my parents also, because I now respond differently to power and control when I experience it from other people, and that changes the system. So it's a small thing. It's a super local small thing. I didn't climb the Himalayas. I didn't discover DNA. And it's a day-by-day thing. You know, every day when things don't go the way you want them to do, you make a decision about what you're going to do about it. Are you going to engage in equality-based behaviors? Or are you going to engage in power and control behaviors? Are you going to shrink away? What are you going to do? So it's a process, an ongoing process. That's my answer.
Marty, do you realize
Vern, what you want to share? Do you want to wrap this up here? I want to be respectful of people's time.
Yes.
Are you okay with wrapping it up here in the next couple of minutes?
I can wrap it up anytime. I can hit the outro music right now. Do you and Jack want to say anything in closing? I just want to acknowledge Marty for what he just shared is a huge thing, probably bigger than he realizes. If everyone handled their lives on the planet, there would be no need for much of the force that is used to handle it.
Mm.
Jack, do you have anything to
say,
Brian?
As we wrap up?
Jack?
The only thing I want to say is just so that some of the things I said earlier don't get misconstrued. Some of the things I say don't apply in every situation. I think we just saw a fantastic demonstration of vulnerability, and it affected me greatly, and it truly, I think, is that was a powerful thing to do and to say at that time. So when I say, you know, sometimes you don't show vulnerability, sometimes you do.
Brian?
Yeah, I'll piggyback on that and say that the people on this podcast all represent some of my heroes in life. And I'm really happy that we've been able to talk about the hero's journey together as a group. And to go back again to why these people are so heroic in my life is because I do now define heroism very similarly to the way that Campbell did. And that is that a hero is somebody who just tries to build the life that they wish to live. And one of the comments, Vern, that you made at the beginning, this idea that maybe I'm not seen as stereotypically successful, something along those lines, I've really thrown that out as my definition of heroism or of excellence or success, and replaced it with the definition that I currently use, which is I think a hero is somebody who goes about living the sort of life that they want to live, and that's why everybody on this podcast is heroic to me and is constantly challenging me to construct the kind of life that I'd like to live and to mentor other people so that they can have the kinds of lives that they want to live. So I really appreciate everybody.
Well, what a beautiful wrap-up. I thank you all. It's been a great episode number 9. We'll see all our listeners next time here on Journey into Excellence.